This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Heidi Adams-Fitzpatrick in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Aji says she returned home, hoping to find peace, but instead met violence from people who consider the returnees Boko Haram militants.
And that's Moki Edwin Kinzeka filing from Cameroon on efforts to reintegrate former Boko Haram fighters and their captives into society. Also, Zimbabwe's new president has sworn in his cabinet with a promise to tackle the economy first. And a new report urges governments to pay more attention to HIV among adolescents. We'll have these stories and more for you, so stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. And in our top story this hour, Zimbabwe's new president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, has sworn in his cabinet, which he has packed with ruling party loyalists and military men. It's their takeover that helped oust former President Robert Mugabe. Mnangagwa is calling for Zimbabweans to unite. He says his top priority is to revive the country's battered economy. Sebastian Mofu is in Harare for us with this report.
Mnangagwa, President of the Republic of Zimbabwe.
Members of Zimbabwe's cabinet took the oath of office Monday to work under the new president, Emmerson Mnangagwa. It is the first time in Zimbabwe's 37-year history the oath is not being led by Robert Mugabe. The 75-year-old Mnangagwa answered some questions following the ceremony.
A new cabinet, just to finish the term of the former president, which is a period of between 6 to 7 months. It has been hectic, but I believe that with my team, we will stand to the challenge. That I want them united, we must grow our economy.
Mnangagwa took power last month in a military-led coup after the 93-year-old Mugabe fired him as vice president. The new president has not indicated if he will seek a fresh term in elections expected by middle of next year. A few meters from the State House, street vendor Vengai Muhawa commented about the new cabinet. He says he hopes the government addresses the problem of cash shortages at banks instead of relying on plastic money, and he said it must create jobs. He says street vendors want to be chased by employers so that we get off the streets. Next to him is another street vendor, Silas Mawera. He says the composition of the new cabinet is okay, and Zimbabweans are expecting it to quickly address the economy so vendors do not have to remain in the streets. Besides attending to the economy, Zimbabwe's new president must unite his own ZANU-PF party, which was divided for years over who should succeed Mugabe. Many party members begged Mnangagwa, but others supported Mugabe's wife, Grace. The Mugabes have been granted immunity from prosecution and remain in Zimbabwe, living as private citizens. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
Since 2009, Boko Haram has waged a violent insurgency in the Lake Chad Basin, claiming more than 20,000 lives and forcing around 2 million people to flee their homes. The group's rise and resilience is a major threat to security and stability in the region. But what happens to those who leave the terrorist group? The United Nations is working with the governments of Cameroon, Nigeria and Chad to reintegrate rehabilitated former Boko Haram fighters and their captives into society. The move is already facing resistance in some corners. Moki Edwin Kinzeka visited Kolofata in northern Cameroon and filed this report.
200 women and children said to be ex-Boko Haram militants are in a makeshift camp here at Kolofata on Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria. The women say most of them were captured and kept in the Sambisa forest, where they served as cooks and were subjected to rape and sexual slavery. They were eventually forced to join Boko Haram as fighters, spies, and suicide bombers. Their sons were trained to fight, and daughters became suicide bombers. Among the ex-militants is Maimuni Aji, a 34-year-old mother of three. She says they were saved from Boko Haram training camps after troops from Cameroon, Chad, and Nigeria, operating under a multinational joint task force, attacked Sambisa for 3 consecutive weeks in May 2017. She lost her remaining daughter in the attack. 2 others went as suicide bombers and have never returned. Aji says she returned home, hoping to find peace, but instead met violence from people who consider the returnees Boko Haram militants. She says her nightmare is not over. She says if she had not gone to buy food 2 weeks ago, she would have been killed in the fire that burned her house. She says she is left with nothing but a copy of her identity card that proves that she is a citizen of her village. Boko Haram forcibly recruited thousands of youths in Nigeria, Cameroon, Chad, and Niger in its effort to create an Islamic state in West Africa. Muhammad Jamil, president of Nigerian Muslim Youths, says communities should accept the returning fighters and stop stigmatization, which may make them more radical. He says the military should also stop persecuting them as if they were still fighters.
The law enforcement agents are using excessive force on these people, such that even the innocent citizens have been killed alongside the militants, and that is giving the innocent citizen the thinking that the government is not for us, is against us, and now they lend more support to the extremists, give them cover. So we should reduce the force that we use in containing this. Dialogue, inclusive dialogue, is what will solve this, and not force.
Villagers say the ex-fighters and captives may be returning with Boko Haram ideology or be spies. Mohammed Chambers, the UN Special Representative in West Africa, says the worries of the population are legitimate. But Chambers says Cameroon, Nigeria, and Chad should promote de-radicalization centers to help reintegrate the former fighters and victims.
They have succeeded in pushing Boko Haram back. So on that security front, there has been good success, and we all commend the military efforts that have been taken. At the same time, let us address issues of governance, of bringing on board women and youth to tackle the root causes of violent extremism in Central Africa, in West Africa, in the Sahel.
Cameroon and the UN have been distributing seeds, goats, sheep and pigs to the returnees and asking their communities to welcome them. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Kolofata.
Yemen's former president Ali Abdullah Saleh was killed today after his motorcade was stopped by Houthi militiamen who were pursuing him as he fled the capital, Sana'a. Amateur video released by Houthi media show the former president with an apparent gunshot wound to the head being carried off in a blanket. Edward Uranian with a story from Cairo.
It was a bitter end for the former president who had ruled the north of Yemen and then a united north and south for nearly 34 years. His death came at the hand of Houthi militiamen who were pursuing him and a number of close aides as they attempted to flee fighting inside the capital, Sana'a. Members of his political party claim Saleh had been killed at point-blank range after his 3-vehicle convoy was stopped by Houthi militiamen. One of his sons was also reportedly shot and taken captive by the Houthis. Arab media claimed Iranian drones detected the former president's motorcade leaving Sana'a and alerted the Houthis, who said Saleh was fleeing to territory under control of the Saudi-led coalition. He had broken with the pro-Iranian militia group on Saturday by offering to negotiate with the coalition. In a televised speech Monday, Houthi leader Abdul Malik al-Houthi declared victory against Saleh. He says the Houthis have put a stop to a massive plot which represented a serious threat to the country and to its stability and security, as well as the unity of its people, by handing it over to its enemies after they had failed to capture it in nearly 3 years of battle. Houthi went on to blast Saleh for betraying the loyalty of those he had worked with and claimed that ordinary people of the capital could not understand how he had changed sides after 3 years of denouncing the Saudi-led coalition. The rebel leader claimed many ordinary Yemenis were shocked by Saleh's calls for strife, combat, upsetting peace and security, and he says he tried in a fraternal and peaceful way to avoid the current conflict by talking with Saleh. As president of Yemen, Saleh had fought the Houthis in five conflicts between 2005 and 2012, before allying with them in 2014 after the Saudi-led coalition launched a military operation to restore the internationally recognized president, Abdrabbu Mansour Hadi, after the Houthis had deposed and arrested him. Former U.S. diplomat David Mack, now with the Middle East Institute, told VOA Saleh was one of the smartest political operatives in the Arab world, and the former president believed he had been unjustly driven from office by countries of the Gulf Cooperation Council in accord with the United States. Mack told VOA before news of Mr. Saleh's death, the former president wanted to have one chance to restore his reputation, which had been terribly, terribly damaged during the past decade.
He's gone from having the reputation of being the supremely capable political operator within Yemen to being somebody who was just out for personal power and was prepared to see tremendous suffering of Yemeni people in the process.
The whereabouts of Saleh's son and political heir, Tariq, who was leading the fight against the Houthis in the capital at the head of the Presidential Guard Regiment, remain unclear. The former president's supporters have suffered serious military setbacks during the past 48 hours. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
A new report says governments have to do more to engage young people in the fight against HIV and AIDS. There's been considerable progress in the tackling of the pandemic, but every day there are an estimated 1,700 new infections among young people around the world. Henry Ridgewell is in London for us with more.
It is time policymakers recognise that HIV-positive adolescents face unique challenges, says the report from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine alongside the charity Centre Bali. Among the recommendations are that young people receive adequate psychosocial support, a human rights-based approach to testing and care, and finding ways to sensitively discuss sex and relationships for adolescents living with HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. Professor Rashida Ferrand co-authored the research.
We really need to be thinking about all the barriers at every step in that broad environment, both at facility level and in clinics, etc., but also recognizing the fact that most of the time young people do not spend in facilities. So we have to think of modifying the environments and the barriers that those environments place.
Campaigners say many adolescents in Africa are unaware of their HIV status and are afraid to get tested. 23-year-old Masedi Kewamodimo was born with HIV. Both her parents died from AIDS. Growing up in her native Botswana, Masedi grew frustrated with the barriers she faced and decided to reveal her HIV status in order to campaign for better treatment. She spoke to VOA about that decision.
It's one of the most difficult thing I've ever faced in my whole life. Every single day I face difficult stigma. People talk about it because, one, they fear it. Two, they assume certain people within our society have it. Three, they feel that they cannot welcome people who are living with HIV and AIDS.
The charity Centre Bale, which helped put together the policy recommendations, was co-founded by Prince Harry, who is newly engaged to American actress Meghan Markle. She has also campaigned on health issues in Africa. Earlier this year, the prince chaired a meeting in London on adolescents with HIV, titled Let Youth Lead, and called for a change in global education on the disease.
Young people, the first time they know or the first time they hear anything about HIV and AIDS is probably by the time it's too late. Whether it's in the education system here in the UK, whether it's across Africa, whether it's across the world, HIV needs to be treated exactly the same as any other disease.
Campaigners hope the royal couple's star power will help them spread the vital message that young people's needs and fears must be addressed in the global drive to tackle HIV and AIDS. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Aisha Hamid is an artist whose work focuses on migration, Afrofuturistic music and stories, as well as the transatlantic slave trade. Hamid's latest work connects these themes with a story of Drexia, a mythical underwater country populated by unborn children of pregnant African women who were thrown off slave ships. Hamid talked to Ricky Shryock about this world and how it relates to today's real-world migration crisis.
This is something that's pressing and it's ongoing and it's not resolved, and I think it's only getting heightened. Like, as we talked about during the session, that apart from the few examples that I brought up, that there's other ways to sort of think about contemporary slavery, of jettison in the present, etc. My own academic work was on the Black Atlantic, but the kind of art, my art practice and my kind of more activist practice has been in contemporary migration. So in a sense, the analogy sort of came quite organically from thinking those two things together. And then I realized it wasn't that abstracted.
The tying in of Afrofuturistic music, it's really fascinating. Why do you think that adds an element to presenting the work and maybe even raising awareness, like we said, about contemporary issues and tying the past to what's going on?
Well, that's really funny, actually, because my background's not in music, but I came across Drexia a few years ago and was so taken with this story that they had of slaves who were thrown overboard. It's absolutely fascinating. And this idea of taking such a violent history and then turning it into this story of survival, right? And not only survival, but really almost joyful survival, because actually what happens is that these Drexians, they adapt from living in amniotic fluid to underwater, which is just completely a violent image. But then they develop gills, they develop flippers, they start jumping the waves, and then they jump into outer space, they colonize a planet. And when in interviews that I've read with Drexia, they don't actually often make reference to this originary story that I mentioned in my talk. They actually more just talk about the different forms of mutation that they perform underwater. So in a way, to me, that became such an interesting way of staying with the trouble, staying with the violent moment, but also to bring in other time periods, because I think there's something about juxtaposing two moments and seeing what comes out of that as opposed to making direct causal links. And so I thought that that's how... And so what happened was is that I started listening to their music, and then the kind of vocabulary that I was using to understand their music, you might not have noticed it, but it's really visual. I started hearing in their music the kind of experiments that they were trying to sort of explore about underwater living and about alternative life forms.
Aisha Hamid is a lecturer in visual culture at London's Goldsmiths University. She spoke to Ricky Shryock in Dakar. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Police in Nigeria have confirmed that six officers were killed in a clash with cattle herders last week in the country's northeast. Police say the attack happened on Friday when officers went to disarm Fulani herdsmen who were reported to be armed. More than 30 people have been killed in the Numan region over the past several weeks in clashes between nomadic herdsmen and farmers. The central states have suffered years of ethnic and sectarian violence as farmers and herdsmen fight over land and water. South Sudan's government says it's ready for the revitalization forum on the 2015 peace agreement and that it's committed to improving the peace deal. The government says for its part, it'll make sure any issues blocking the implementation of the agreement are addressed. Manyang David Meyer reports from Juba.
The Troika statement called on the Juba government to stop pursuing military victory and work to implement its promise to allow unfettered access to humanitarian workers. The statement also said the Troika will, quote, continue to identify and hold responsible those who work against peace, including through economic and other sanctions, unquote. It also warned that leaders who use their positions to fuel conflict and amass illicit wealth from the South Sudanese people will face consequences. South Sudan government spokesperson Michael McQuaid insists the government is committed to restoring peace in the country and dismisses Troika's threats of sanctions.
They have the right to have their opinion. But for us, we have already clearly stated that we are for the revitalization and that the revitalization will be inclusive. All these threats are uncalled for.
Although McQuaid mentioned inclusivity in the revitalization process, he says he still has some reservations on the presence of former First Vice President Riek Machar at the talks.
Riek Machar, to me, is not the inclusivity. Inclusivity is the representation of all of the strain groups, full stop. It does not necessarily include him, but it includes his representatives.
However, without key players like Machar in the revitalization forum, his supporters and others say the process will not be successful. McQuaid says the 2015 peace deal can work.
We are improving on it. We are strengthening it so that some of the provisions which are unimplementable can become implementable. An example is to have the ceasefire, the cessation of hostilities, negotiate all the outstanding issues, then sign the permanent ceasefire, accommodate the strain groups. The objective of all these is to see how best we will come out with a reasonable time frame that will lead to elections.
Sanctions imposed by the U.S. on leaders on both sides include Michael McQuaid. The information minister is accused of impeding the peace process. For VOA News, I'm Manyang David Mayar in Juba.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Heidi Adams Fitzpatrick in Washington. For all the latest development on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports that's coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Joe Gill, thank you for choosing the Voice of America.
Africa, I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. VOA. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5-minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.
Looking for something? Headline news, interviews, analysis? We've got it all on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.